Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There was a very significant reverse in that war yesterday here in America. A federal judge by the name of Bernard Friedman in the U.S. District Court in Detroit, Michigan, ruled that a statute that has been on the books since 1996 was unconstitutional. This federal statute prohibited female genital mutilation, one of the most barbaric activities known to modern man, that is being inflicted, we're told, or will be, on perhaps as many as 513,000 women and girls in the United States. A woman who has devoted much of her life to protecting such innocent victims from all kinds of horrors is our first guest. Her name is Elizabeth Yore. She is an attorney by training with a distinguished record of public service in her native state of Illinois, but also at the federal level. She has, in recent years, been active in trying to bring to an absolute end this practice of FGM, as it's called, in the United States. I wanted to catch up with her immediately as the leader of a really important initiative, the End FGM Today campaign, to talk about what Judge Friedman has wrought and what needs to be done about it. Liz Yore, thank you so much for coming back on our air. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you, Frank, and thank you for giving this important issue the important coverage it needs.
Well, I hate that this is the occasion for us talking about this. Usually you've been sharing with us developments that you have been helping advance, particularly at the state level and with federal prosecutors to try to bring this activity to a screeching halt. But tell us what the judge has done here and its implications.
Yes. Well, you know, Frank, I have covered this case. I've been up to Detroit, Michigan, sat in on the pretrial hearing. So I feel very strongly that this is an important case, albeit a case of first impression.
And remind us what the case is, Liz.
Yes, this is a case where the federal government has indicted a doctor, two doctors, number of medical clinic people, as well as a number of mothers who all were in a conspiracy, the government argues, to have their daughters, their young daughters, ages 7 through 10, nine victims, as a matter of fact, from Michigan, Minnesota, and Illinois, mutilated, undergo this procedure called female genital mutilation by a Dr. Nargawala. This case was filed in April of 2017 against members of a Dawoodi Bohra Shia sect. It's a Muslim sect originating out of India. And Frank, there are 22 Dawoodi Bohra mosques in the United States, in 12 states. And the spiritual leader of this Shia sect ordered from the pulpit that all little girls must be cut, mutilated, their female genitals mutilated under the law of this cult. And so as a result, the federal government, there's been a federal law in the books, as you mentioned, since 1996, and this is the first big prosecution. And kudos to the Trump administration. You know, for 18 years, We know this has been going on in the United States, and for 18 years, there has really been no federal prosecution. It's a fairly strong federal statute, but Judge Bernard Friedman in the federal court up in Detroit found this statute just yesterday to be unconstitutional, that the government had not met its burden under the Commerce Clause, that there was not enough significant or any economic activity, which is required under the Commerce Clause, to uphold this statute.
But as I understand it, specifically, the deficiency in the statute, Liz, according to Judge Friedman, was that reference to the Commerce Clause that gives the federal government standing, I guess you'd call it, to intervene in this kind of behavior and criminalize it. In the absence of that Commerce Clause language, the government couldn't do this constitutionally. So this now brings us to the question, so what do we do about this? The implications, as I understand it, Liz, are that there is now no federal prohibition on FGM, and there is no prohibition on FGM in 23 of our 50 states. Does that mean that today we could have women and girls being mutilated with complete impunity, at least in those 23 states?
Absolutely. As we speak, it's game on. FGM is no longer criminalized under the federal law, and there are 23 states. I mean, this is shocking, Frank. 23 states in our country that have not criminalized this procedure. So we need to move with speed and with absolute purpose, contacting our senators and congressmen and women to immediately make this fixed. We've got to get this fixed because little girls in the United States, as we speak, are going to be subjected to this hideous and barbaric form of, I think it's one of the most vile forms of child abuse in existence.
Yeah, and as I mentioned, you've devoted your life to trying to prevent child abuse, and you've done so with great effect, Liz Uehr. This must be extraordinarily aggravating in the extreme that we've got this reverse. Is there a vehicle in the United States Congress that could be used to move smartly to make this necessary change in the law in this lame duck session of Congress, if at all possible?
I believe so. This is where Americans get it, Frank. We can get this fixed done. There is a law on the books that was passed last year. It's called the SAFE Act. It should be easy for your audience to listen. And remember, the SAFE Act increased penalties. This is the irony of it. Increased penalties from 5 to 15 years for FGM. It passed unanimously in Congress at a time when nothing passed unanimously in the House. And it is now pending in the Senate. We need our female senators, you know, the feminists in the Senate, to lead this fight to fix the law, to increase the penalties for FGM, and to do it immediately in this lame duck session.
Get it done. Every day is a day of risk for some unknown number of little girls, some as young as 7 years old, who will find their genitals being mutilated without their permission, needless to say, and to their great detriment for the rest of their lives. Liz Uehr, I'm afraid we are out of time to do more than just say H.R. 3317, the SAFE Act, that stands for Stopping Abusive Female Exploitation. It is pending in the United States Senate. If this year of the woman means anything, it should mean that women and girls are protected against FGM, female genital mutilation. Liz Uehr, thank you for the work you do at End FGM Today. I believe you can be found there with much more information on all of this at endfgmtoday.com.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It's time for one of my favorite visits of the week, and that is with our regular Dinah West, the longtime syndicated columnist, blogger par excellence, pundit, commentator, and, well, invaluable guest on this radio program. You can find her writings on dianawest.net. Also, her two terrific books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Dinah, again, a happy Thanksgiving to you.
The same to you. Thank you.
Thank you. So just a quick question. I was speaking a moment ago with Liz Uehr about this ruling by the federal judge on female genital mutilation in America, in which we observed, among other things, that the effect of this ruling will be to clear the decks in 23 states across the country at the moment for women and girls to be mutilated with impunity. Your thoughts?
Yes. Well, there are a number of thoughts I have, beginning with the notion that we were told some years ago that continuing immigration from the parts of the world where this is custom, Islamic parts of the world, parts of the African continent, would have nothing to do with bringing this practice to the United States, that we would never see this kind of thing taking place here as a cause of immigration. And yet we spoke about how the demographic changes would bring with it these sorts of customs, and so they have. And I would just like to go on the record saying that this did happen as we said it would. Now what to do about it? It is barbarous. It must remain barbarous. It is not a matter of custom or habit that can be taken into this country. We have certain laws and standards and understandings of human dignity and grace. That said, the urgency for the states to put these laws on the books becomes paramount. And we also have an opportunity in this lame duck session to address this at the federal level in the Senate. So these become two prongs to prevent this from becoming the American way.
Speaking of the American way, Diana West, you have written brilliantly about something that happened to this country back in November of 1933. And I wanted you to reprise for us your piece at the Epoch Times, the day you say our fundamental transformation, a term we associate with Barack Obama, actually began.
Yes, well, I use that phrase purposefully because I do believe that the transformation, the fundamental transformation of Barack Obama, did have its start some 85 years ago under FDR. That began when the United States, reversing the policy of four presidents before FDR, recognized the Soviet regime. Even though the Soviet regime, the Soviet Union, was openly committed to destroying us, to overthrowing our form of government by force and by subterfuge. And the thing that's amazing about the agreement is that the terms of the agreement stipulated specifically that the Soviet Union was not to support groups in this country engaged in overthrowing the United States of America. In other words, they were to have nothing to do with revolution here. Now, of course, they were at that moment so engaged. And after this agreement was signed, the floodgates opened. And by that, it's almost literally true in the sense that communists, pro-communists, Soviet agents, fellow travelers entered the federal government with impunity, open arms, although the covert ones remained covert, but all of a sudden communism was normalized. And further, the reason it's a fundamental transformation goes to the fact that in order to preserve this agreement, the United States had to adopt a code of deception itself, because in order to continue this recognition, continue this diplomatic status, and so on, we had to pretend that the Soviet Union was not engaged in these activities, which became increasingly well known to the authorities, the FBI, the Congress, and so on. And thus began what I see as a rise of double standards officially, the rise of official lying, the acceptance of big lies, the rise of moral relativism itself. And I think that this only, you know, you start to see the concentric circles around this event going out into all manner of American culture and society. And so this is why I do look at it as the beginning of a fundamental transformation.
It's so stunning that we've had really a succession of these false promises out of the Kremlin, initially, of course, under the Soviet regime, but in its aftermath, under that of Vladimir Putin, that betray every trust we've placed in them and have done us, I believe, incalculable harm. And you have documented so much of that in American Betrayal, Diana, and I think it's really to your great credit that you've been able to help connect dots, but what is stunning to me is we never seem to learn. To Donald Trump's great credit, and that of John Bolton, his national security advisor, they're trying to extricate ourselves from bad arms control agreements. I actually had a hand in negotiating the INF treaty, and I think President Trump is absolutely right to be withdrawing from it in the face of very serious violations of that agreement. Diana, it just is stunning to me that so much of this has gone unremarked. So much of this, the cumulative effect of the false promises and the transformations, both internal to our country and in terms of our strategic posture relative to the Russians, has gone forward on the basis of these broken promises and outright lies.
Yes, well, it has been codified over the years. I mean, I have documents from Congress where there are these sort of compendia of lists of treaties of all kinds that were negotiated between the United States and the USSR that are listed in these long columns of broken treaties or never adhered to agreements. I mean, it is a pathology. The late Joseph Douglas Jr. wrote a marvelous book some years ago called something to the effect of Why the Soviet Union Violates Arms Control Treaties. And it essentially goes back to the Marxist ideology, Marxism, Leninism, Stalinism, whereby the goals of the state, the strategic goals of the state, are advanced by any means necessary, and that includes signing phony treaties. And yes, we continue to negotiate in the spirit of this original agreement 85 years ago today, which again wasn't worth the paper it was written on from the moment it was signed. And there were people who always understood this, and these are the truth tellers along the way who are constantly kind of paved over by the conventional wisdom dealers. So this is a continuing problem. Maybe President Trump can highlight it in such a way that more people understand it.
Let's hope. If he does, it will be on the basis, I hope, of your good work, Diana West. Listen, I wanted to turn to one last thing before we run out of time, Diana. I am an enormous admirer of your writing, as you probably have discerned, and our audience certainly knows. Death of the Grown-Up, your first book, really speaks to us in so many different ways, but I couldn't help but think of it again the other day in connection with this brouhaha over the absolutely puerile behavior of Jim Acosta, the White House correspondent for CNN, the temper tantrum that he threw in the president's press conference, and then the lawsuit that he filed to get his credentials restored after they were withdrawn on the basis of his misconduct in that setting. Your thoughts on this example and whether perhaps the grown-ups are back in the form of the White House team now saying there will be a certain amount of decorum or you won't be in the White House.
Right. Right. Well, that is, of course, the solution if the journalists can adhere to it. And it is Jim Acosta's pluralism, as you say, but it is further reinforced by his oh-so-indulgent employers at CNN who actually carried this to court. I mean, I think that they are truly the death of the grown-up exhibits here who failed to discipline their own reporter.
Well, actually enabled it, I think it's fair to say.
That's right, and perpetuated it and made it something even larger than it ever should have been. But I actually hope that this continues because these incredibly vacuous people think that they're doing something important, thinking they're doing something having to do with the First Amendment. It just goes to show how terribly blind they continue to be and self-obsessed. Because you and I have had the privilege to know so many of these true freedom seekers, truly heroes of free speech who face death and terrible repression because they try to speak out in their respective milieu. And this just only highlights the inadequacies and smallness of the mainstream media today. And I hope that the American people continue to follow this because it really is an indictment of these professionals.
Well, and of course, Donald Trump has sort of captured this whole problem with his comments about fake news. But I think it's not simply the content of the news. It's the increasing partisanship of those who are bringing it to us that is so much on display in this case with Jim Acosta. Diana, we have to leave it at that for the moment, but so much more to talk about on the other side of the holiday break. I hope that, again, yours is a good one, and I am thankful for you and your family every day. Keep up the good work, my dear, at dianawest.net. Check it out, folks, along with Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. We'll talk with you next week. Next up, we'll speak with Gordon Chang about the latest in the U.S.-China, well, it seems all-out Cold War, according to Vice President Mike Pence. That and much more right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being just about every week by our friend and colleague Gordon Chang, one of the country's preeminent experts on matters involving Asia, our economic interests there, as well as our national security, most especially those associated with China, a subject he is deeply knowledgeable about, having lived in China for a time, practiced law there, having written a definitive book on the subject of the coming collapse of China. He is also the author of Nuclear Showdown, North Korea Takes on the World. He is a columnist at the Daily Beast. He contributes to the National Interest and other outlets, notably Fox News and, of course, our program. Gordon, it's always great to have you with us. Happy Thanksgiving to you. Welcome back.
Oh, and happy Thanksgiving to you and your listeners, Frank. And thank you so much.
Thank you. Gordon, I'm interested in your thoughts, particularly about what we might expect from the upcoming G20 meeting between President Trump and President Xi Jinping of China. There's been a lot of talk about a deal. You have just written that no deal is the best deal for America. Walk us through that, please.
Well, the most important thing, Frank, is that we get the Chinese to stop stealing our intellectual property, stop their predatory trade actions, stop stalling. Talking is stalling. And every moment that they stall, they steal more intellectual property. So we talk and we bleed. And so therefore, I think what we need to do is just to say to the Chinese, look, you just got to stop this stuff. And we're going to continue to impose costs and we'll continue to increase those costs until you stop this behavior. It just seems to me that we've been talking for two decades with the Chinese about World Trade Organization violations, all their acts which are directed against the international community. They're closing up their economy, and China's just moving in regressive directions. So there's nothing that we really can do except to make sure that the costs that they bear are higher than the benefits they receive. So I don't see what talking is going to do. Now, many people think that we should sit down with Xi Jinping. There's a meeting planned at the G20 in Buenos Aires, which starts at the end of this month. I don't see how we're going to come to any sort of accommodation with China there. But even if we do have a deal, it's not going to last. We've seen so many temporary deals with the Chinese fall apart because they continue to violate their obligations. They are in no position at this particular time to deal in faith, good faith, with the international community.
You know, as you're talking, Gordon, it strikes me that even if they were to stop stealing our technology and engaging in other kinds of infractions of their World Trade Organization commitments. And I would note that there's been some recent reporting about an $8.75 billion, it's been called the Great Microchip Heist of Micron Technology proprietary information by the Chinese, just as one example. Would that really take care of it? Or is that really simply a symptom of what we're dealing with in China? The vice president warned on his way back from a rather contentious meeting with Xi Jinping in Singapore about an all-out Cold War. Isn't that what we're in at the moment? And if so, would these relatively minor but important, certainly, but relatively minor adjustments be nearly sufficient?
Well, one thing is we should be getting back from China all the value of the theft that they have committed over the course of decades. But that's going to be very difficult. What's important for us to realize, and this is, I think, the general direction of your question, is that their theft, their intellectual property thieving, their predatory trade practices, they're at the heart of the communist system. And China's party cannot stop the behavior that is so inimical to our society and to just good order in the world. That leads to the conclusion that the world is not big enough for the People's Republic of China and the United States of America. Our political class has yet to come to that conclusion, but I think that we're moving in that direction. Because largely, I don't see that Xi Jinping so much as an aberration, but is an inevitable result of China's political system. But in the meantime, the best we can do, I guess, is to put the focus on China's theft of intellectual property and say that this is something that the United States cannot abide and that we will do anything short of the use of force to get the Chinese to stop this.
Yeah. I guess what I'm thinking, Gordon, and we've talked about many different manifestations of these problems, the Belt and Road Initiative, their predatory behavior in the South China Sea, their use of other kinds of espionage and influence operations, notably the Confucius Institutes to try to subvert us. I mean, it's really on the macro level, an all-out campaign, a Cold War, if you will, against us. And I think it is important. It's not to deprecate in any way what is trying to be done by this Trump administration, but it does seem as though we would be foolish in the extreme to settle even for a deal on our terms as it relates just to, you know, these property rights and you know, the theft thereof. Speaking of that, Gordon, you have been focused for some time on something that was written up at some length in the Epoch Times just recently about how American academia misleads about China, an article by Jennifer Zhang. I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I know you're familiar with the mechanism through which that misleading is largely done, namely the Chinese Confucius Institutes on quite a number of American campuses and the presence of a lot of Chinese students who are paying full freight for studying often in the hard sciences that are going to almost certainly wind up being brought to bear against us in the future. Talk a little bit about that piece of the Chinese operations against us.
People talk about the Confucius Institutes, which are essentially run by the Communist Party's United Front Work Department, through an organization known as the Hanban. But there are other organizations that I think are even more dangerous, and that is chapters of the Chinese Students and Scholars Association, which often are fronts for the China's Ministry of State Security. Also, we have China's diplomats in its embassy in the United States and the five consulates around our country that directly interfere on American college campuses, often trying to intimidate faculty. So there is a broad-based campaign against the American university and colleges. This is a very difficult a challenge to us because we want to maintain open universities. We want to have students from other countries. Many of those students stay here and enrich the United States. And so this is going to be something that we need to focus on. But I think that the important point here is that, yes, the Chinese have been trying to influence the United States, been trying to take technology and all the rest of it through their activities on campuses. But the important point is that American administrations have let them. We have allowed Ministry of State Security operatives and agents to work on our soil, essentially unimpeded. And this is, I think, a big story about, for instance, the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations. We have been starting to see at the end of the Obama administration and, of course, during the Trump administration, more vigorous action to stop the Chinese. But this is a story of America's lack of vigilance and allowing them to violate our sovereignty.
Gordon, let me come back to something that is also part of this equation of the future direction of U.S.-Chinese relations. You've referred to, in your recent piece in The National Interest, the remarks of the former Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, by any standard you wish, clearly a friend of China, who is warning of a decoupling between the United States and China that he considers to be a very serious peril to both countries, I guess it's fair to say, but not least to the United States. Your thoughts on his remarks?
Secretary Paulson talked about an economic iron curtain descending. And as you say, he believes that's a peril. I believe in these circumstances, it's a good thing. We should be disentangling the American and Chinese economies. We should be getting supply chains out of China. We should get manufacturing either back in the United States or in countries that are friendly to us. This is unfortunate if you think about it in long general terms, but nonetheless, as long as China is ruled by the Communist Party, I'm afraid that we will not have satisfactory relations. So the only alternative is what the Trump administration is wisely doing, and that is disengaging from China. You know, at some point when China is has a democracy, we can have full economic relations and commerce and ties and the rest of it. But until that happy moment, I think we need that iron curtain that, that Paulson's been warning against.
Speaking of the supply chain, Gordon, I had a fascinating hour-long conversation yesterday with Rosemary Gibson. I don't know if you're familiar with her work, but she's written a book called China RX, which discusses in extraordinary and really chilling detail what is happening in terms of our dependency on sources of supply in China of medicines and pharmaceuticals, antibiotics, penicillin, vitamin C, and the like. I don't know if you've looked at this in any detail, Gordon, but I would commend this book to you as I have to our audience. It is a chilling story of the kind of intersectionality, I guess they call it these days, between the United States and China on Chinese terms that is really horrifying and makes the case, as you say, for, I guess, an iron economic curtain.
Yes, this is the one vulnerability that the United States will have difficulty dealing with. All the rest of it we can, over time, solve satisfactorily. But right now, we have this short-term vulnerability because so many of our medicines are made in China.
Yeah. Gordon Chang, thank you, as always, for your counsel on all these matters. Glad to have you back stateside from your travels. And I hope, as ever, that you and your family have a wonderful Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk with you again next week.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. David Goldman joins us roughly this time each week. We are always grateful for his visits. He is, of course, an extraordinarily accomplished essayist and columnist at the Asia Times, writing under the byline of Spengler, his nom de guerre. He is the author of a terrific book, How Civilizations Die, and a regular guest, as I say, here with a special insight into some of the flashpoints around the world, and especially the economic and sort of geostrategic dimensions thereof, that we want to tap his brain on several at the moment. David Goldman, welcome back. So good to have you, sir.
Frank Gaffney, thanks for the kind words. Always a pleasure to talk with you, sir.
Thank you. Let me ask you first, David, you follow events far beyond Asia very closely, and we've talked in the past few weeks about this so-called Khashoggi affair. The president has engaged very directly and in the face of considerable criticism from some on both sides of the aisle, essentially placing a priority on maintaining the important strategic relationship with not just Saudi Arabia, but the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, despite the claims by some that the Central Intelligence Agency, certainly the Turks and others, insist he was directly implicated in the death and dismemberment of this fellow Khashoggi. Tell us your thoughts on the president's stance.
I think the president is exactly right. The choices in Saudi Arabia, which is a Game of Thrones medieval kingdom, are not pleasant and they're not extensive. There are basically two ways Saudi can go. One is it maintains the rule of a royal family, which is really a throwback to a different era, which rules in a very brutal and, to us, repugnant way. And the other is that in place of the royal family, we get a modern totalitarian Islamist vanguard party, the Muslim Brotherhood, replacing the Saudi monarchy. That's really about all that can happen. And between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is a terrorist totalitarian operation, which you, Frank, and your Center for Security Policy have done so much work to expose, between that and the Saudi royal family, we're much better off with the existing order, and that's NBS. Now, I consider it completely credible that they committed an atrocious assassination of a nasty character. Remember, Jamal Khashoggi was, in fact, a Muslim Brotherhood sympathizer, perhaps an operative. Now, as for the intelligence community, for the last 15 years, everybody has promoted to the ranks in the intel community, both in the Bush administration and the Obama administration, has gone in with the premise that we're going to bring about Islamist democracy in the Middle East. We supported Mohammed Morsi, the short-lived, or short duration, I should say, Muslim Brotherhood president of Egypt. That was a disaster. Egypt nearly starved to death as a result. We supported the Islamist who overthrew Gaddafi and the Islamist who became ISIS eventually. And it's something Michael Flynn warned about in that infamous Defense Intelligence Agency report of a few years ago. So there's a lot of sympathy in the intelligence community. David Ignatius at the Washington Post is sort of the public spokesman for it, who believe in this fantasy of Islamist democracy and side with the Muslim Brotherhood. I think they're making a big mistake. They've had a terrible policy failure, but they haven't admitted to it. Trump wants to get rid of all that, so he's probably at odds with a lot of people in the intelligence community. Without knowing the details, I'd say absolutely, I'm 100% for Trump in this. I think he's magnificently right to face down this kind of nonsense from the deep state.
Yeah, I do too. And David, I think your insights are so important. We've almost entirely lost perspective of the alternative, and whether it's, as you say, the Muslim Brotherhood inside Saudi Arabia, or it's the Muslim Brotherhood's backers in Turkey and Qatar, or whether it's their helpmates in Iran. The alternatives here are pretty unsavory, and I'm no particular fan, I have to say, of the House of Saud, but of the bunch, Mohammed bin Salman certainly seems to be the most closely aligned, at least for the moment, with our vital interests, and therefore seems to me to be a guy that we're going to need to continue, as the president has said, working with.
I agree with you completely. It's not a matter of good guys and bad guys. It's a matter of our guys and their guys.
Well, maybe even temporarily ours, but that beats the Deccans out of the alternative. Let me ask you, David, staying in the Middle East for another moment, about Israel. You've written several pieces recently that I thought were worth noting. One concerning what a senior administration official shared with you in terms of America's attitude towards and role going forward with respect to the threat now facing our friends in Israel from Hezbollah and an enormous array of missiles that are aimed at the Jewish state from South Lebanon at the moment.
Well, Hezbollah has 130,000 missiles pointed at Israel, overwhelmingly of Iranian manufacture. It's one of the largest armies in the world, in fact. And they're all embedded in villages in southern Lebanon, where there is a dense Shiite Arab population. The obvious objective of Hezbollah, their obvious game, is to shoot missiles at Israel, compel Israel to strike at Hezbollah, which would kill a lot of the civilian human shields protecting the missiles, and then go to the United Nations and say Israel's committing atrocities and try to get the world community to do their job for them. The administration official I spoke with about exactly this scenario said, that's not going to happen. Not only will we diplomatically support Israel in the case of a northern war, just as we have in Gaza, but there have already been extensive co-training exercises between American anti-missile forces using the Patriot batteries and Israeli anti-missile capabilities. This exercise is called Juniper Cobra. The last version was held last spring in Israel with several thousand American military participants. The official I spoke to was very firm that they were not going to let Hezbollah get away with this revolting and cynical use of human shields as a way of trying to discredit Israel. So I was very encouraged to hear that.
It is encouraging, and I hope that message is being received loud and clear by Hezbollah and the Iranians as well, because certainly everything that can be done to deter this coming conflict, I fear it is going to be upon us before too long, but anything that can stave that off is certainly to be desired. You've written with an old friend of mine, Mark Zell, an interesting piece about Israel and China. It took off on some comments that were written by another of our recent guests, Arthur Herman. Tell us a little bit, David Goldman, about what role Israel is playing with China and concerns that perhaps that may have some implications for compromising security as a result of technology and particularly weapons transfers.
Well, Israel 15 years ago was selling some of its own avionics to the Chinese. The Defense Department objected. I think it was Douglas Feith who took the initiative there, and the Israelis stopped. Since then, the Israelis have limited all of their tech exports to China to things like water management, clean tech, environmental, and so forth. They've been very careful to exclude any military technology from any of their now rapidly increasing trade and investment relations with China. The main thing that Mark and I talked about in the article is what an incredible benefit Trump's tough policy towards China has been to the Israelis. There's only one thing that really concerns the Israelis as an existential threat. That's Iran. And of course, China is Iran's major supplier of weapons, major trading partner, and of course, the whole Iranian nuclear weapons program depended on assistance from China. So China has an enormous capacity, if it so chooses, to influence events in Iran. And to the extent China wants to get out from under the trade restrictions, which the president and his people have imposed, the Israelis have made very clear to China they're going to have to be good world citizens dealing with Iran. They can't be supporting a terrorist state on one side and claiming to cooperate as a good world partner on the other on trade. So I think the Israelis have succeeded diplomatically in getting the Chinese to understand how very dangerous their relationship with Iran has been for their overall standing in the world and their trade relations with the United States.
David Goldman, thank you again for the work you do at Asia Times and so many places beyond, but most especially here. We hope you'll be coming back to us again next week. This is Frank Gaffney. Until then, over and out.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.